The Ascent of Mount Carmel by St. John of the Cross, Book 2, Chapter 13, wherein are set down the signs which the spiritual person will find in himself, whereby he may know at what season it behoves him to leave meditation and reasoning, and pass to the state of contemplation. In order that there may be no confusion in this instruction, it will be meet in this chapter to explain at what time and season it behoves the spiritual person to lay aside the task of discursive meditation, as carried on through the imaginations and forms and figures above mentioned, in order that he may lay them aside neither sooner nor later than when the Spirit bids him. For although it is meet for him to lay them aside at the proper time, in order that he may journey to God and not be hindered by them, it is no less needful for him not to lay aside the said imaginative meditation before the proper time, lest he should turn backward. For although the apprehensions of these faculties serve not as proximate means of union to the proficient, they serve nevertheless as remote means to beginners in order to dispose and habituate the spirit to spirituality by means of sense, and in order to void the sense, in the meantime, of all of the other low forms and images, temporal and worldly and natural. We shall therefore speak here of certain signs and examples which the spiritual person will find in himself, whereby he may know whether or not it will be meet for him to lay them aside at this season. The first sign is his realization that he can no longer meditate or reason with his imagination, neither can take pleasure therein as he was wont to do aforetime. He rather finds aridity in that which aforetime was wont to captivate his senses and bring him sweetness. But for as long as he finds sweetness in meditation and is able to reason, he should not abandon this, save when his soul is led into the peace and quietness which is described under the third head. The second sign is a realization that he has no desire to fix his meditation or his sense upon other particular objects, exterior or interior. I do not mean that the imagination neither comes nor goes, for even at times of deep recollection it is apt to move freely, but that the soul has no pleasure in fixing it of set purpose upon other objects. The third and surest sign is that the soul takes pleasure in being alone, and waits with loving attentiveness upon God without making any particular meditation, in inward peace and quietness and rest, and without acts and exercises of the faculties, memory, understanding, and will. At least without discursive acts, that is, without passing from one thing to another. The soul is alone, with an attentiveness and a knowledge, general and loving, as we said, but without any particular understanding, and adverting not to that which it is contemplating. These three signs, at least, the spiritual person must observe in himself altogether before he can venture safely to abandon the state of meditation and sense, and to enter that of contemplation and spirit. And it suffices not for a man to have the first alone without the second. For it might be that the reason for his being unable to imagine and meditate upon the things of God, as he did aforetime, was distraction on his part, and lack of diligence. For the which cause he must observe in himself the second likewise, which is the absence of inclination or desire to think upon other things. For when the inability to fix the imagination and sense upon the things of God proceeds from distraction or lukewarmness, the soul then has the desire and inclination to fix it upon other and different things, which lead it thence altogether. Neither does it suffice that he should observe in himself the first and second signs, if he observe not likewise, together with these, the third. For although he observed his inability to reason and think upon the things of God, and likewise his distaste for thinking upon other and different things, this might proceed from melancholy, or from some other kind of humor in the brain and the heart, which habitually produces a certain absorption and suspension of the senses, causing the soul to think not at all, nor to desire or be inclined to think, but rather to remain in that pleasant state of reverie. Against this must be set the third sign, which is loving attentiveness and knowledge, in peace, etc., as we have said. It is true, however, that, when this condition first begins, the soul is hardly aware of this loving knowledge, and that for two reasons. First, this loving knowledge is apt at the beginning to be very subtle and delicate, and almost imperceptible to the senses. Secondly, when the soul has been accustomed to that other exercise of meditation, which is wholly perceptible, it is unaware and hardly conscious of this new and imperceptible condition, which is purely spiritual. Especially when, not understanding it, the soul allows not itself to rest in it, but strives after the former, which is more readily perceptible. So that abundant though the loving interior peace may be, the soul has no opportunity of experiencing and enjoying it. But the more accustomed the soul grows to this, by allowing itself to rest, the more it will grow therein, and the more conscious it will become of that loving general knowledge of God, in which it has greater enjoyment than anything else, since this knowledge causes it peace, rest, pleasure, and delight, without labor. And to the end that what has been said may be the clearer, we shall give in this chapter following the causes and reasons why the three signs aforementioned appear to be necessary for the soul that is journeying to pure spirit. Chapter 14, wherein is proved the fitness of these signs, and the reason is given why that which has been said in speaking of them is necessary to progress. With respect to the first sign whereof we are speaking, that is to say, that the spiritual person who would enter upon the spiritual road, which is that of contemplation, must leave the way of imagination and of meditation through sense, when he takes no more pleasure therein, and is unable to reason. There are two reasons why this should be done, which may almost be comprised in one. The first is that in one way the soul has received all the spiritual good which it would be able to derive from the things of God by the path of meditation and reasoning. The sign whereof is that it can no longer meditate or reason as before, and finds no new sweetness or pleasure therein as it found before, because up to that time it had not progressed as far as the spirituality which was in store for it. For as a rule, whensoever the soul receives some spiritual blessing, it receives it with pleasure, at least in spirit, in that means whereby it receives it and profits by it. Otherwise it is astonishing if it profits by it, or finds in the cause of it that help and that sweetness which it finds when it receives it. For this is in agreement with a saying of the philosophers, quod sapit nutrit. This is, that which is palatable, nourishes, and fattens. Wherefore, holy Job said, numquid poterit comedi insulsum, quod non est sale conditum. Can that which is unsavory perchance be eaten, when it is not seasoned with salt? It is this cause that the soul is unable to meditate or reason as before. The little pleasure which the spirit finds therein, and the little profit which it gains. The second reason is that the soul at this season has now both the substance and the habit of the spirit of meditation. For it must be known that the end of reasoning and meditation on the things of God is the gaining of some knowledge and love of God. And each time that the soul gains this through meditation, it is an act. And just as many acts of whatever kind end by forming a habit in the soul, just so many of these acts of loving knowledge, which the soul has been making one after another from time to time, come through repetition to be so continuous in it that they become habitual. This end God is wont also to effect in many souls without the intervention of these acts, or at least without many such acts having preceded it, by setting them at once in contemplation. And thus that which aforetime the soul was gaining gradually through its labor of meditation upon particular facts, has now through practice, as we have been saying, become converted and changed into a habit and substance of loving knowledge, of a general kind, and not distinct or particular as before. Wherefore, when it gives itself to prayer, the soul is now like one to whom water has been brought, so that he drinks peacefully, without labor, and is no longer forced to draw the water through the aqueducts of past meditations and forms and figures. So that as soon as the soul comes before God, it makes an act of knowledge, confused, loving, passive, and tranquil, wherein it drinks of wisdom and love and delight. And it is for this cause that the soul feels great weariness and distaste, when, although it is in this condition of tranquility, men try to make it meditate and labor in particular acts of knowledge. And for it is like a child, which while receiving the milk which has been collected and brought together for it in the breast, is taken from the breast, and then forced to try to gain and collect food by its own diligent squeezing and handling. Or it is like one who has removed the rind from a fruit, and is tasting the substance of the fruit, when he is forced to cease doing this, and to try to begin removing the said rind which has been removed already. He finds no rind to remove, and yet he is unable to enjoy the substance of the fruit which he has already had in his hand. Herein he is like to one who leaves a prize which he holds for another which he holds not. And many act thus when they begin to enter this state. They think that the whole business consists of a continual reasoning and learning to understand particular things by means of images and forms, which are to the spirit like rind. When they find not these in that substantial and loving quiet wherein their soul desires to remain, and wherein it understands nothing clearly, they think that they are going astray and wasting time, and they begin once more to seek the rind of their imaginings and reasonings, but find it not, because it has already been removed. And thus they neither enjoy the substance nor make progress in meditation, and they become troubled by the thought that they are turning backward and are losing themselves. They are indeed losing themselves, though not in the way they think, for they are becoming lost to their own senses and to their first manner of perception. And this means gain in that spirituality which is being given them. The less they understand, however, the farther they penetrate into the night of the spirit, whereof we are treating in this book, through the which night they must pass in order to be united with God, in a union which transcends all knowledge. With respect to the second sign, there is little to say, for it is clear that at this season the soul cannot possibly take pleasure in other and different objects of the imagination, which are of the world. Since, as we have said, and for the reasons already mentioned, it has no pleasure in those which are in closest conformity with it, namely, those of God. Only, as has been noted above, the imaginative faculty in this state of recollection is in the habit of coming and going and varying of its own accord, but neither according to the pleasure nor at the will of the soul, which is troubled thereby, because its peace and joy are disturbed. Nor do I think it necessary to say anything here concerning the fitness and necessity of the third sign, whereby the soul may know if it is to leave the meditation aforementioned, which is a knowledge of God, or a general and loving attentiveness to him. For something has been said of this in treating of the first sign, and we shall treat of it again hereafter, when we speak in its proper place of this confused and general knowledge, which will come after our description of all the particular apprehensions of the understanding. But we will speak of one reason alone, by which it may be clearly seen how, when the contemplative has to turn aside from the way of meditation and reasoning, he needs this general and loving attentiveness, or knowledge, of God. The reason is that, if the soul at that time had not this knowledge of God, or this realization of his presence, the result would be that it would do nothing and have nothing, for having turned aside from meditation, by means whereof the soul has been reasoning with its faculties of sense, and being still without contemplation, which is the general knowledge whereof we are speaking, wherein the soul makes use of its spiritual faculties, namely, memory, understanding, and will, these being united in this knowledge, which is then wrought and received in them, the soul would of necessity be without any exercise in the things of God, since the soul can neither work, nor can it receive that which has been worked in it, save only by way of these two kinds of faculty, that of sense and of that of spirit. For as we have said, by means of the faculties of sense, it can reason and search out and gain knowledge of things. And by means of the spiritual faculties, it can have fruition of the knowledge which it has already received in these faculties aforementioned, though the faculties themselves take no part herein. And thus the difference between the operation of these two kinds of faculty in the soul is like the difference between working and enjoying the fruit of work which has already been done, or like that between the labor of journeying and the rest and quiet which comes from arrival at the goal. Or again, like that between preparing a meal and partaking and tasting of it, when it has been both prepared and masticated, without having any of the labor of cooking it. Or it is like the difference between receiving something and profiting by that which has been received. Now, if the soul be occupied neither with respect to the operation of the faculties of sense, which is meditation and reasoning, nor with respect to that which has already been received and affected in the spiritual faculties, which is the contemplation and knowledge whereof we have spoken, it will have no occupation, but will be wholly idle, and there would be no way in which it could be said to be employed. This knowledge, then, is needful for the abandonment of the way of meditation and reasoning. But here it must be made clear that this general knowledge whereof we are speaking is at times so subtle and delicate, particularly when it is most pure and simple and perfect, most spiritual and most interior, that although the soul be occupied therein, it can neither realize it nor perceive it. This is most frequently the case when we can say that it is in itself most clear, perfect, and simple. And this comes to pass when it penetrates a soul that is unusually pure and far withdrawn from other particular kinds of knowledge and intelligence, which the understanding or the senses might fasten upon. Such a soul, since it no longer has those things wherein the understanding and the senses have the habit and custom of occupying themselves, is not conscious of them, inasmuch as it has not its accustomed powers of sense. And it is for this reason that when this knowledge is purest and simplest and most perfect, the understanding is least conscious of it, and thinks of it as most obscure. And similarly, and contrariwise, when it is in itself least pure and simple in the understanding, it seems to the understanding to be clearest and of the greatest importance, since it is clothed in, mingled with, or involved in, certain intelligible forms which understanding or sense may seize upon. This will be clearly understood by the following comparison. If we consider a ray of sunlight entering through a window, We will see that the more the said ray is charged with atoms and particles of matter, the more palpable, visible, and bright it appears to the eye of sense. Yet it is clear that the ray is in itself least pure, clear, simple, and perfect at that time, since it is full of so many particles and atoms. And we see likewise that when it is purest and freest from those particles and atoms, the least palpable and the darkest does it appear to the material eye. And the purer it is, the darker and less apprehensible it appears to it. And if the ray were completely pure and free from all these atoms and particles, even from the minutest specks of dust, it would appear completely dark and invisible to the eye, since everything that could be seen would be absent from it, namely, the objects of sight. For the eye would find no objects whereon to rest, since light is no proper object of vision, but the means whereby that which is visible is seen. So that if there be no visible objects wherein the sun's ray or any light can be reflected, nothing will be seen. Wherefore, if the ray of light entered by one window and went out by another, nothing will be seen. Wherefore, if the ray of light entered by one window and went out by another without meeting anything that has material form, it would not be seen at all. Yet notwithstanding, that ray of light would be purer and clearer in itself than when it was more clearly seen and perceived through being full of visible objects. The same thing happens in the realm of spiritual light with respect to the sight of the soul, which is the understanding, and which this general and supernatural knowledge and light whereof we are speaking strikes so purely and simply. So completely is it detached and removed from all intelligible forms, which are objects of the understanding, that it is neither perceived nor observed. Rather, at times, that is, when it is purest, it becomes darkness, because it withdraws the understanding from its accustomed lights, from forms and from fancies, and then the darkness is more clearly felt and realized. But when this divine light strikes the soul with less force, it neither perceives darkness nor observes light, nor apprehends anything that it knows, from whatever source. Hence, at times the soul remains, as it were, in a great forgetfulness, so that it knows not where it has been or what it has done, nor is it aware of the passage of time. Wherefore it may happen, and does happen, that many hours are spent in this forgetfulness, and when the soul returns to itself, it believes that less than a moment has passed, or no time at all. The cause of this forgetfulness is the purity and simplicity of this knowledge which occupies the soul, and simplifies, purifies, and cleanses it from all apprehensions and forms of the senses and of the memory, through which it acted when it was conscious of time, and thus leaves it in forgetfulness and without consciousness of time. This prayer, therefore, seems to the soul extremely brief, although, as we say, it may last for a long period. For the soul has been united in pure intelligence, which belongs not to time. And this is the brief prayer which is said to pierce the heavens, because it is brief and because it belongs not to time. And it pierces the heavens because the soul is united in heavenly intelligence. And when the soul awakens, this knowledge leaves in it the effects which it created in it without its being conscious of them, which effects are the lifting up of the spirit to the heavenly intelligence, and its withdrawal and abstraction from all things and forms and figures and memories thereof. It is this that David describes as having happened to him when he returned to himself out of the same forgetfulness, saying, Vigilavi, et factus sum sicut passert solitarius in tecto, which signifies, I have watched, and I have become like the lonely bird on the housetop. He uses the word lonely to indicate that he was withdrawn and abstracted from all things. And by the housetop, he means the elevation of the spirit on high, so that the soul remains as though ignorant of all things, for it knows God only, without knowing how. Wherefore the bride declares in the songs that among the effects which that sleep and forgetfulness of hers produced was this unknowing. She says that she came down to the garden saying, Nashivi, that is, I knew not whence. Although, as we have said, the soul in this state of knowledge believes itself to be doing nothing, and to be entirely unoccupied, because it is working neither with the senses nor with the faculties, it should realize that it is not wasting time. For although the harmony of the faculties of the soul may cease, its intelligence is as we have said. For this cause, the bride, who was wise, answered this question herself in the songs, saying, Ego dormio et cor meum vigilat. As though she were to say, although I sleep with respect to my natural self, ceasing to labor, my heart waketh, being supernaturally lifted up in supernatural knowledge. But it must be realized, we are not to suppose that this knowledge necessarily causes this forgetfulness when the soul is in the state that we are here describing. This occurs only when God suspends in the soul the exercise of all its faculties, both natural and spiritual, which happens very seldom. For this knowledge does not always fill the soul entirely. It is sufficient for the purpose, in the case which we are treating, that the understanding should be withdrawn from all particular knowledge, whether temporal or spiritual, and that the will should not desire to think with respect to either. As we have said, for this is a sign that the soul is occupied. And it must be taken as an indication that this is so, when this knowledge is applied and communicated to the understanding only, which sometimes happens when the soul is unable to observe it. For when it is communicated to the will also, which happens almost invariably, the soul does not cease to understand in the very least degree, if it will reflect hereon, that it is employed and occupied in this knowledge, inasmuch as it is conscious of a sweetness of love therein, without particular knowledge or understanding of that which it loves. It is for this reason that this knowledge is described as general and loving, for just as it is so in the understanding, being communicated to it obscurely, even so is it in the will, sweetness and love being communicated to it confusedly, so that it cannot have a distinct knowledge of the object of its love. Let this suffice now to explain how meet it is that the soul should be occupied in this knowledge, so that it may turn aside from the way of spiritual meditation, and be sure that although it seems to be doing nothing, it is well occupied, if it discern within itself these signs. It will also be realized from the comparison which we have made, that if this light presents itself to the understanding in a more comprehensible and palpable manner, as the sun's ray presents itself to the eye when it is full of particles, the soul must not for that reason consider it purer, brighter, and more sublime. It is clear that, as Aristotle and the theologians say, the higher and more sublime is the divine light, the darker is it to our understanding. Of this divine knowledge there is much to say concerning both itself and the effects which it produces upon contemplatives. All this we reserve for its proper place, for although we have spoken of it here, there would be no reason for having done so at such length, save our desire not to leave this doctrine rather more confused than it is already, for I confess it is certainly very much so. Not only is it a matter which is seldom treated in this way, either verbally or in writing, being in itself so extraordinary and obscure, but my rude style and lack of knowledge make it more so. Further, since I have misgivings as to my ability to explain it, I believe that I often write at too great length and go beyond the limits which are necessary for that part of the doctrine which I am treating. Herein, I confess that I sometimes err purposely, for that which is not explicable by one kind of reasoning will perhaps be better understood by another, or by others yet. And I believe, too, that in this way I am shedding more light upon that which is to be said hereafter. Wherefore it seems well to me also, before completing this part of my treatise, to set down a reply to one question which may arise with respect to the continuance of this knowledge, and this shall be briefly treated in the chapter following. End of chapter 14.